Chapter 4. That day, the birthday of Clara Olsovyevna, the only daughter of the civil councillor Berendiev, at one time Mr. Golyadkin's benefactor and patron, was being celebrated by a brilliant and sumptuous dinner party, such as had not been seen for many a long day within the walls of the flats in the neighbourhood of Ismailovsky Bridge. A dinner more like some Balthazar's feast, with a suggestion of something Babylonian in its brilliant luxury and style, with Veuve Clicquot champagne, with oysters and fruit from Eliseyev's and Milyutin's, with all sorts of fatted calves and all grades of the government service. This festive day was to conclude with a brilliant ball, a small birthday ball, but yet brilliant in its taste, its distinction, and its style. Of course, I am willing to admit that similar balls do happen sometimes, though rarely. Such balls, more like family rejoicings than balls, can only be given in such houses as that of the civil councillor Berendiev. I will say more. I even doubt if such balls could be given in the houses of all civil councillors. Oh, if I were a poet, such as Homer or Pushkin, I mean, of course, with any lesser talent one would not venture, I should certainly have painted all that glorious day for you, O my readers, with a free brush and brilliant colours. Yes, I should begin my poem with my dinner. I should lay special stress on that striking and solemn moment when the first goblet was raised to the honour of the Queen of the Fate. I should describe to you the guests plunged in a reverent silence and expectation, as eloquent as the rhetoric of Demosthenes. I should describe for you then how Andrei Filippovich, having as the eldest of the guests some right to take precedence, adorned with his grey hairs and the orders what well befit grey hairs, got up from his seat and raised above his head the congratulatory glass of sparkling wine, brought from a distant kingdom to celebrate such occasions, and more like heavenly nectar than plain wine. I would portray for you the guests and the happy parents raising their glasses too after Andrei Filippovich, and fastening upon him eyes full of expectation. I would describe for you how the same Andrei Filippovich, so often mentioned, after dropping a tear in his glass, delivered his congratulations and good wishes, proposed the toast, and drank the health. But I confess, I freely confess, that I could not do justice to the solemn moment when the Queen of the Fate, Clara Olsovyevna, blushing like a rose in spring, with the glow of bliss and of modesty, was so overcome by her feelings that she sank into the arms of her tender mamma. How that tender mamma shed tears, and how the father, Olsufi Ivanovich, a hale old man and a privy councillor, who had lost the use of his legs in his long years of service and been rewarded by destiny for his devotion with investments, a house, some small estates, and a beautiful daughter, sobbed like a little child, and announced through his tears that His Excellency was a benevolent man. I could not, I positively could not, describe the enthusiasm that followed that moment in every heart, an enthusiasm clearly evinced in the conduct of a youthful register clerk, though at that moment he was more like a civil councillor than a register clerk, who was moved to tears too as he listened to Andrei Filippovich. In his turn, too, Andrei Filippovich was, in that solemn moment, quite unlike a collegiate councillor and the head of an office in the department. Yes, he was something else. What exactly, I do not know, but not a collegiate councillor. He was more exalted. Finally, oh, why do I not possess the secret of lofty, powerful language, of the sublime style, to describe these grand and edifying moments of human life, which seem created expressly to prove that virtue sometimes triumphs over ingratitude, free-thinking, vice, and envy? I will say nothing, but in silence, which will be better than any eloquence, I will point to that fortunate youth, just entering on his 26th spring, to Vladimir Semyonovitch, Andrei Filipovitch's nephew, who in his turn now rose from his seat, who in his turn proposed a toast, and upon whom were fastened the tearful eyes of the parents, the proud eyes of Andrei Filipovitch, the modest eyes of the queen of the fete, the solemn eyes of the guests, and even the decorously envious eyes of some of the young man's youthful colleagues. I will say nothing of that, though I cannot refrain from observing that everything in that young man, who was indeed speaking in a complimentary sense, more like an elderly than a young man, everything, from his blooming cheeks to his accessorial rank, seemed almost to proclaim aloud the lofty pinnacle a man can attain through morality and good principles. I will not describe how Anton Antonovitch Svyetototchkin, a little old man as grey as a badger, the head clerk of a department, who was a colleague of Andrei Filipovitch's, and had once been also of Olsufi Ivanovitch's, and was an old friend of the family and Clara Olsuvyevna's godfather, in his turn proposed a toast, crowed like a cock, and cracked many little jokes. How by this extremely proper breach of propriety, if one may use such an expression, he made the whole company laugh till they cried, and how Clara Olsuvyevna, at her parents' bidding, rewarded him for his jocularity and politeness with a kiss. I will only say that the guests, who must have felt like kinsfolk and brothers after such a dinner, at last rose from the table, and the elderly and more solid guests, after a brief interval spent in friendly conversation, interspersed with some candid, though of course very polite and proper observations, went decorously into the next room, and without losing valuable time, promptly divided themselves up into parties, and, full of the sense of their own dignity, installed themselves at tables covered with green baize. Meanwhile, the ladies established in the drawing-room suddenly became very affable and began talking about dress materials. And the venerable host, who had lost the use of his legs in the service of loyalty and religion, and had been rewarded with all the blessings we have enumerated above, began walking about on crutches among his guests, supported by Vladimir Semyonovitch and Clara Olsuvyevna, and he, too, suddenly becoming extremely affable, decided to improvise a modest little dance, regardless of expense. To that end, a nimble youth, the one who was more like a civil councillor than a youth, was dispatched to fetch musicians, and musicians to the number of 11 arrived, and exactly at 8:30 struck up the inviting strains of a French quadrille, followed by various other dances. It is needless to say that my pen is too weak, dull, and spiritless to describe the dance that owed its inspiration to the genial hospitality of the grey-headed host. And how, I ask, can the modest chronicler of Mr. Golyadkin's adventures, extremely interesting as they are in their own way, how can I depict the choice and rare mingling of beauty, brilliance, style, gaiety, polite solidity, and solid politeness, sportiveness, joy, all the mirth and playfulness of these wives and daughters of petty officials, more like fairies than ladies, in a complimentary sense, with their lily shoulders and their rosy faces, their ethereal figures, their playfully agile, homeopathic, to use the exalted language appropriate, little feet. How can I describe to you, finally, the gallant officials, their partners? Gay and solid youths, steady, gleeful, decorously vague, smoking a pipe in the intervals between the dancing, in a little green room apart, or not smoking a pipe in the intervals between the dances, every one of them with a highly respectable surname and rank in the service. All steeped in a sense of the elegant and a sense of their own dignity. Almost all speaking French to their partners, or, if Russian, using only the most well-bred expressions, compliments, and profound observations, and only in the smoking room permitting themselves some genial lapses from this high tone, some phrases of cordial and friendly brevity, such, for instance, as, "'Pon my soul, Petka, you rake, you did kick me off that polka in style!' Or, "'I say, Vasya, you dog, you did give your partner a time of it!' For all this, as I've already had the honour of explaining, oh, my readers, my pen fails me. And therefore I am dumb. Let us rather return to Mr. Goliadkin, the true and only hero of my very truthful tale. The fact is that he found himself now in a very strange position, to the least of it. He was here also, gentlemen, that is, not at the dance, but almost at the dance. He was all right, though. He could take care of himself. Yet at that moment he was a little astray. He was standing at that moment, strange to say, on the landing of the back stairs to Olsufi Ivanovich's flat. But it was all right, his standing there. He was quite well. He was standing in a corner, huddled in a place which was not very warm, though it was dark, partly hidden by a huge cupboard and an old screen, in the midst of rubbish, litter, and odds and ends of all sorts, concealing himself for the time being, and watching the course of proceedings as a disinterested spectator. He was only looking on now, gentlemen. He, too, gentlemen, might go in, of course. Why should he not go in? He had only to take one step, and he would go in, and would go in very adroitly. Just now, though he had been standing nearly 3 hours between the cupboard and the screen, in the midst of the rubbish, litter, and odds and ends of all sorts, he was only quoting in his own justification a memorable phrase of the French minister, Villèle, "All things come in time to him who has the strength to wait." Mr. Goliadkin had read this sentence in some book on quite a different subject, but now very aptly recalled it. The phrase, to begin with, was exceedingly appropriate to his present position. And indeed, why should it not occur to the mind of a man who had been waiting for almost 3 hours in the cold and the dark, in expectation of a happy ending to his adventures? After quoting very appropriately the phrase of the French minister, Villèle, Mr. Goliadkin immediately thought of the Turkish vizier, Matsimiris, as well as of the beautiful Margravine Louise, whose story he had read also in some book. Then it occurred to his mind that the Jesuits made it their rule that any means were justified if only the end were attained. Fortifying himself somewhat with this historical fact, Mr. Goliadkin said to himself, "What were the Jesuits? The Jesuits were, every one of them, very great fools. that he was better than any of them, that if only the refreshment room would be empty for 1 minute. The door of the refreshment room opened straight into the passage to the back stairs, where Mr. Goliadkin was in hiding now. He would, in spite of all the Jesuits in the world, go straight in. First from the refreshment room into the tea room, then into the room where they were now playing cards, and then straight into the hall where they were now dancing the polka. And he would go in. He would slip through, and that would be all. No one would notice him, and, once there, he would know what to do. Well, so this is the position in which we find the hero of our perfectly true story, though indeed it is difficult to explain what was passing in him at that moment. The fact is that he had made his way to the back of the stairs and to the passage on the ground that, as he said, why shouldn't he? And everyone did go that way. But he had not ventured to penetrate further. Evidently he did not dare to do so. Not because there was anything he did not dare, but just because he did not care to. Because he preferred to be in hiding, so here he was, waiting now for a chance to slip in. And he had been waiting for it 2 hours and a half. Why not wait? Villel himself had waited. But what had Villel to do with it, thought Mr. Goliadkin.
How does Villel come in? But how am I to go and walk in? Ah, you dummy, said Mr. Goliadkin, pinching his benumbed cheek with his benumbed fingers. You silly fool, you silly old Goliadkins, oh, silly fool of a surname!
But these compliments paid to himself were only by the way and without any apparent aim. Now he was on the point of pushing forward and slipping in. The refreshment room was empty, and no one was in sight. Mr. Goliadkin saw all this through the little window. In 2 steps he was at the door, and had already opened it. Should he go in or not? Come, should he or not?
I'll go in. Why not? To the bold always lie open?
Reassuring himself in this way, our hero suddenly and quite unexpectedly retreated behind the screen.
No, he thought. Ah, now somebody's coming in. Yes, they've come in. Oh, why did I dawdle when there were no people about? Even so, shall I go and slip in? No, how slip in when a man has such a temperament? Oh, fie, what a low tendency! I'm as scared as a hen. Being scared is our special line, that's the fact of the matter. To be abject on every occasion is our line. No need to ask us about that. Just stand here like a post, and that's all. At home I should be having a cup of tea now. It would be pleasant, too, to have a cup of tea. If I come in later, Petrushka'll grumble, maybe. Shall I go home? Oh, damnation, take all this. I'll go, and that'll be the end of it.
Reflecting on his position in this way, Mr. Goliadkin dashed forward as though someone had touched a spring in him. In 2 steps he found himself in the refreshment room, flung off his overcoat, took off his hat, hurriedly thrust these things into a corner, straightened himself and smoothed himself down, then he moved on to the tea room. And from the tea room darted into the next room, slipped almost unnoticed between the card players, who were at the tip-top of excitement. Then Mr. Goliadkin forgot everything that was going on about him and went straight as an arrow into the drawing-room. As luck would have it, they were not dancing. The ladies were promenading up and down the room in picturesque groups. The gentlemen were standing about in twos and threes, or flitting about the room, engaging partners. Mr. Goliadkin noticed nothing of this. He saw only Clara Olsovyevna. Near her, Andrei Filipovich, then Vladimir Semyonovich, two or three officers, and finally two or three other young men who were also very interesting and, as anyone could see at once, were either very promising or had actually done something. He saw someone else, too. Or rather, he saw nobody and looked at nobody, but moved by the same spring which had sent him dashing into the midst of a ball to which he had not been invited, he moved forward, and then forwarder and forwarder. On the way, he jostled against a councillor and trod on his foot, and incidentally stepped on a very venerable old lady's dress and tore it a little. Pushed against a servant with a tray, and then ran against somebody else, and not noticing all this, passing further and further forward, he suddenly found himself facing Clara Olsovyevna. There is no doubt whatever that he would, with the utmost delight, without winking an eyelid, have sunk through the earth at that moment. But what has once been done cannot be recalled, can never be recalled. What was he to do?
If I fail, I don't lose heart. If I succeed, I persevere.
Mr. Goliadkin was, of course, not one to intrigue, and not accomplished in the art of polishing the floor with his boots, and so, indeed, it proved. Besides, the Jesuits had some hand in it too, though Mr. Goliadkin had no thoughts to spare for them now. All the moving, noisy, laughing groups were suddenly hushed as though at a signal, and little by little crowded round Mr. Goliadkin. He, however, seemed to hear nothing, to see nothing. He could not look. He could not possibly look at anything. He kept his eyes on the floor, and so stood, giving himself his word of honour in passing to shoot himself one way or another that night. Making this vow, Mr. Goliadkin inwardly said to himself, "Here goes." And to his own great astonishment, began unexpectedly to speak. He began with congratulations and polite wishes. The congratulations went off well, but over the good wishes our hero stammered. He felt that if he stammered, all would be lost at once. And so it turned out. He stammered and floundered. Floundering, he blushed crimson. Blushing, he was overcome with confusion. In his confusion, he raised his eyes. Raising his eyes, he looked about him. Looking about him, he almost swooned. Everyone stood still. Everyone was silent. A little nearer, there was laughter. Mr. Goliadkin fastened a humble, imploring look on Andrei Filipovich. "Andrei Filipovich." Andrei Filipovich responded with such a look that if our hero had not been utterly crushed already, he certainly would have been crushed a second time, that is, if that were possible. The silence lasted long.
"This is rather concerned with my domestic circumstances and my private life, Andrei Filipovich,"
our hero, half dead, articulated in a scarcely audible voice.
"It is not an official incident, Andrei Filipovich."
"For shame, sir! For shame!"
Andrei Filipovich pronounced in a half whisper, with an indescribable air of indignation. He pronounced these words, and, giving Clara Olsovyevna his arm, he turned away from Mr. Goliadkin.
"'I've nothing to be ashamed of, Andrei Filipovich,' answered Mr. Golyadkin, also in a whisper, turning his miserable eyes about him, trying helplessly to discover in the amazed crowd something on which he could gain a footing and retrieve his social position. "'Why, it's all right. It's nothing, gentlemen. Why, what's the matter? Why, it might happen to anyone,'
whispered Mr. Golyadkin, moving a little away and trying to escape from the crowd surrounding him. They made way for him. Our hero passed through two rows of inquisitive and wondering spectators. Fate drew him on. He felt himself that fate was leading him on. He would have given a great deal, of course, for a chance to be back in the passage by the back stairs without having committed a breach of propriety. But as that was utterly impossible, he began trying to creep away into a corner and to stand there, modestly, decorously, apart, without interfering with anyone, without attracting especial attention— but at the same time to win the favourable notice of his host and the company. At the same time, Mr. Golyadkin felt as though the ground were giving way under him, as though he were staggering, falling. At last he made his way to a corner and stood in it, like an unconcerned, rather indifferent spectator, leaning his arms on the back of two chairs, taking complete possession of them in that way, and trying, as far as he could, to glance confidently at Olsufi Ivanovich's guests, grouped about him. Standing nearest him was an officer, a tall and handsome fellow, beside whom Golyadkin felt himself an insect.
"'These two chairs, Lieutenant, are intended, one for Clara Olsuvievna, and the other for Princess Chevchehanov. I'm taking care of them for them,'
said Mr. Golyadkin breathlessly, turning his imploring eyes on the officer. The lieutenant said nothing, but turned away with a murderous smile. Checked in this direction, our hero was about to try his luck in another quarter, and directly addressed an important counsellor with a cross of great distinction on his breast. But the counsellor looked him up and down with such a frigid stare that Mr. Golyadkin felt distinctly as though a whole bucketful of cold water had been thrown over him. He subsided into silence. He made up his mind that it was better to keep quiet, not to open his lips, and to show that he was all right, that he was like everyone else, and that his position, as far as he could see, was quite a proper one. With this object, he riveted his gaze on the lining of his coat, then raised his eyes and fixed them upon a very respectable-looking gentleman.
"'That gentleman has a wig on,' thought Mr. Golyadkin. "'And if he takes off that wig, he will be bald. "'His head will be as bare as the palm of my hand.'
"'Having made this important discovery, "'Mr. Golyadkin thought of the Arab emirs, "'whose heads are left bare and shaven "'if they take off the green turbans they wear "'as a sign of their descent from the Prophet Muhammad.' Then, probably from some special connection of ideas with the Turks, he thought of Turkish slippers, and at once, apropos of that, recalled the fact that Andrei Filipovich was wearing boots, and that his boots were more like slippers than boots. It was evident that Mr. Golyadkin had become, to some extent, reconciled to his position.
"'What if that chandelier—' flashed through Mr. Golyadkin's mind, "'were to come down from the ceiling and fall upon the company. "'I should rush at once to save Clara Olsuvievna. "'Save her!' I should cry. Oh, "'Don't be alarmed, madam, it's of no consequence. "'I will rescue you.
At that moment Mr. Golyadkin looked about in search of Clara Olsuvievna, and saw Gerasimich, Osufi Ivanovich's old butler. Gerasimych, with a most anxious and solemnly official air, was making straight for him. Mr. Golyadkin started and frowned from an unaccountable but most disagreeable sensation. He looked about him mechanically. It occurred to his mind that if only he could somehow creep off somewhere, unobserved, on the sly, simply disappear, that is, behave as though he had done nothing at all, as though the matter did not concern him in the least. But before our hero could make up his mind to do anything, Gerasimych was standing before him.
"Do you see, Gerasimych?" said our hero, with a little smile, addressing Gerasimych. "You go and tell them. Do you see the candle there in the chandelier, Gerasimych? It will be falling down directly, so you know you must tell them to see to it. It really will fall down, Gerasimych."
The candle's standing straight. "But somebody is asking for you, sir."
"Who is asking for me, Gerasimych?"
"I really can't say, sir, who it is. A man with a message. 'Is Yakov Petrovich Golyadkin here?' says he. 'Then call him out,' says he, 'on very urgent and important business.' You see?"
"No, Gerasimych, you are making a mistake. In that, you are making a mistake, Gerasimych."
"I doubt it, sir."
"No, Gerasimych, it isn't doubtful. There's nothing doubtful about it, Gerasimych. Nobody's asking for me, but I'm quite at home here, that is, in my right place, Gerasimych."
Mr. Golyadkin took breath and looked about him. Yes, everyone in the room, all had their eyes fixed upon him, and were listening in a sort of solemn expectation. The men had crowded a little nearer, and were all attention. A little further away, the ladies were whispering together. The master of the house made his appearance at no great distance from Mr. Golyadkin, and though it was impossible to detect from his expression that he, too, was taking a close and direct interest in Mr. Golyadkin's position, for everything was being done with delicacy, yet, nevertheless, it all made our hero feel that the decisive moment had come for him. Mr. Golyadkin saw clearly that the time had come for a bold stroke, the chance of putting his enemies to shame. Mr. Golyadkin was in great agitation. He was aware of a sort of inspiration, and in a quivering and impressive voice he began again, addressing the waiting butler.
"No, my dear fellow, no one's calling for me. You are mistaken. I will say more. You were mistaken this morning, too, when you assured me, dared to assure me, I say—" he raised his voice, "that Osufi Ivanovich, who has been my benefactor for as long as I can remember, and has in a sense been a father to me, was shutting his door upon me at the moment of solemn family rejoicing for his paternal heart."
Mr. Golyadkin looked about him complacently, but with deep feeling. A tear glittered on his eyelash.
"I repeat, my friend," our hero concluded, "you were mistaken. You were cruelly and unpardonably mistaken."
The moment was a solemn one. Mr. Golyadkin felt that the effect was quite certain. He stood with modestly downcast eyes, expecting Osufi Ivanovich to embrace him. Excitement and perplexity were apparent in the guests. Even the inflexible and terrible Gerasimych faltered over the words,
"I doubt it,"
when suddenly the ruthless orchestra, apropos of nothing, struck up a polka. All was lost. All was scattered to the winds. Mr. Golyadkin started. Gerasimych stepped back. Everything in the room began undulating like the sea, and Vladimir Semyonovich led the dance with Clara Olsovyevna, while the handsome lieutenant followed with Princess Chevchehanov. Onlookers, curious and delighted, squeezed in to watch them dancing the polka, an interesting, fashionable new dance which everyone was crazy over. Mr. Golyadkin was, for the time, forgotten. But suddenly all were thrown into excitement, confusion, and bustle. The music ceased. A strange incident had occurred. Tired out with the dance, and almost breathless with fatigue, Clara Olsovyevna, with glowing cheeks and heaving bosom, sank into an armchair, completely exhausted. All hearts turned to the fascinating creature, all vied with one another in complimenting her and thanking her for the pleasure conferred on them. All at once, there stood before her Mr. Golyadkin. He was pale, extremely perturbed. He, too, seemed completely exhausted. He could scarcely move. He was smiling for some reason. He stretched out his hand imploringly. Clara Olsovyevna was so taken aback that she had not time to withdraw hers and mechanically got up at his invitation. Mr. Golyadkin lurched forward, first once, then a second time, then lifted his leg, then made a scrape, then gave a sort of stamp, then stumbled. He, too, wanted to dance with Clara Olsovyevna. Clara Olsovyevna uttered a shriek. Everyone rushed to release her hand from Mr. Golyadkin's, and in a moment our hero was carried almost 10 paces away by the rush of the crowd. A circle formed round him, too. Two old ladies, whom he had almost knocked down in his retreat, raised a great shrieking and outcry. The confusion was awful. All were asking questions. Everyone was shouting. Everyone was finding fault. The orchestra was silent. Our hero whirled round in his circle and mechanically, with a semblance of a smile, muttered something to himself such as, "Why not?" and that the polka, so far at least as he could see, was a new and very interesting dance, invented for the diversion of the ladies, but that since things had taken this turn, he was ready to consent. But Mr. Golyadkin's consent no one apparently thought of asking. Our hero was suddenly aware that someone's hand was laid on his arm, that another hand was pressed against his back, that he was, with peculiar solicitude, being guided in a certain direction. At last he noticed that he was going straight to the door. Mr. Golyadkin wanted to say something, to do something, but no, he no longer wanted to do anything. He only mechanically kept laughing in answer. At last he was aware that they were putting on his greatcoat, that his hat was thrust over his eyes. Finally, he felt that he was in the entry on the stairs, in the dark and cold. At last he stumbled. He felt that he was falling down a precipice. He tried to cry out, and suddenly he found himself in the courtyard. The air blew fresh on him. He stood still for a moment. At that very instant, the strains reached him of the orchestra striking up again. Mr. Golyadkin suddenly recalled it all. It seemed to him that all his flagging energies came back to him again. He had been standing as though riveted to the spot. But now he started off and rushed away headlong, anywhere, into the air, into freedom, wherever chance might take him.